I want to start out with a few, well, of course, thank you first to Hans and Dalton for getting me over here to Turkey. This is my first time at the Property and Freedom Society conference, and it has been an eye-opener. Usually, I go to these conferences and I listen to, I was in the Mont Pelerin Society last year, and half the stuff sort of hurt my ear. So, and so far at the PFS, it has been really good. So thank you, Hans and Galton. Another caveat that I would throw in there is that I caught a cold while flying over here. So if I end up, in the words of Galton, as one of the not so good speakers of the PFS, please forgive me. And I know there's a lot of caveats, but the third one I have to throw at you is that when I chose this topic, from the title, basically, I can talk about anything I want to, right? I did it on purpose because keep it flexible. I originally wanted to talk about the pricking the bubble, the China bubble, that had that was that sort of the story of China's rise in the world, in the world's media, from the Western media to developing country media. Everyone thought that China's rise was not unstoppable. And with the events that had unfolded since I picked this topic, I want to, because right now, things has happened. And I know people of the PFS conference loves data, so I'm going to present a chart first. This is from Bloomberg. This is a chart about the news reporting of China hard landing. As you can see from this chart, there has been a recent parabolic rise of these scare stories about China. So me adding another one to it, I don't think would be very helpful to the crowd here. I myself, by training or by profession, is a financial analyst slash commentator. So it is my profession to make predictions. One that, well, if I don't want to lose any money for me or my readers, one that has to remain ideologically neutral. But I would say, first of all, that the Austrian School Economics is extremely useful in the sense that it has taught me and helped me predict what would unfold whenever a policy came out. A skill set that Paul Krugman doesn't have, obviously. But I wanted today to talk about what is the what is in the minds of the policymakers in China right now. And we have to go back to the absolute basics about what are the long-standing policy objective of the Chinese Communist Party. And socialist utopia for the proletariat. I see someone shaking their fist in China. Of course, let's not kid ourselves. So let's get to the real policy objective of the Chinese Communist Party. They are consistent this way because they are consistent with all the other politicians around the world, which is simply to stay in power. That is the only goal that they have. This is a hat tip to James Buchanan and his public choice theory. But staying in power is what they want to do and what they will do. Whatever policy they enact would be in trying to achieve this. And the threat to their rule, I don't think has been greater since the founding of the People's Republic of China. I would want to get back into history first. From the period of 1949 to 1978, of course, we had Chairman Mao as the leader of China. He passed away in 1976, but you know, his hand-picked successor ran China for two more years until a name called, a fellow called Deng Xiaoping rose to power. But in the Mao era, he, in pursuit of the staying in power goal, you have to have a slight understanding about recent Chinese history. Since the, probably for the last few hundred years, China has been attacked over and over again by foreign powers. And my name is Andrew because my father wanted to call me Charles, but my mother thought that, you know, she doesn't want her son to be named after a prince. So my father thought it would be funny to suggest Andrew, and she said yes. So I am the embodiment of that foreign power incursion into China, because I used to be, for the first 20 years of my life, a loyal subject of the Queen Elizabeth, because I lived in Hong Kong. And in 1979, from 1949 to 1978, Chairman Mao was absolutely obsessed with just one idea in order to stay in power, which is border integrity. All that talk about, you would say that they sort of have that Latin macho about the border integrity of China. And to be honest, if you were to ask any old, really old Chinese Communist Party members, their proudest achievement would be the securing of China's border today. During the Mao period, basically they took back Manchuria, Xinjiang, and Tibet, and secured the entire border area, something that was not seen for the period of at least 100 years prior to that. China got the absurdity of China being carved up can be highlighted during the Treaty of Versailles, when Japan was on the side of the Allied forces, and upon the defeat of Germany, instead of handing the German colonies in China back to China, China was also an ally of the Allied forces, they gave it to Japan. So that was the Chinese Communist Party up and down the entire party structure. That was the policy goal they had in the first epoch. But then it evolved. In 1978, that's Deng. I purposely picked one where he's smoking. He is a big smoker. And I also picked that one. I went to the University of Michigan. So he's a fellow alumni of mine, Gerald Ford. I picked that one because he's an American football player. So you can see how small Deng Xiaoping is. But supposedly his presence is so big that even next to Gerald Ford, of course. But his presence was huge. And he was also obsessed about the question of national security and border integrity. But then you would think, well, Deng Xiaoping's most famous for was his reform movement that opened up China in 1978. You got to understand, for the past few hundred years, the cycle of history has always been the coastal areas of China would begin trading with everyone around the world. And through the process of division of labor and specialization, these coastal areas would accumulate capital and become wealthy. But then these wealthy coastal areas would start to engage in relationships with the foreign powers, and therefore at the end hurt China or break it up. I'm not questioning whether that is a good or bad thing. I'm simply saying that that's in the minds of the Communist Party. So you would say that, then why would Deng, who was so obsessed, like all these old school communists, be willing to open up China, to go as far as saying the white cat or the black cat, which he's referring to socialism and capitalism, whichever cat catches the mice would be a good cat. You know, why he would come out and say, we should let some of the Chinese people rise up in wealth first, you know, instead of the blind pursuit of egalitarianism. This is the reason. This is the a chart. I know you guys love GDP. I mean, you guys love data because it's a great source of humor. But I mean, this data goes back to 1820, so obviously it's, you know. But this is a rough idea. The line demarcates where the reform was put in place. Basically, China's GDP as a percentage of world GDP, this is a rough, of course, rough, right? Went from 30% during the Qing Dynasty all the way down to less than 5%, around 4%. And we're talking about 1/5 of humanity, accounting for only 4% of GDP. So from Deng Xiaoping's point of view, the Chinese economic weakness was so great that he was desperate to create the wealth to protect China. Basically, if China didn't open up, it would become like North Korea, where there will be periodic famines, where the people will be driven through just paranoia into loyalty for the state. But he felt that it would not get to that point, because there is not much in North Korea. I hope there's no Koreans here. But there is plenty of riches in China, both culturally and materially. So foreign powers want to carve it up. And Deng Xiaoping thought, this is it. We have to adopt the capitalist ways in order to strengthen national security. Which brings us, the entire reform movement lasted, I would say the first generation of reforms, lasted until 1989, when two very important events happened that affected the thinking of the Chinese Communist Party. Which, the first one, of course, the iconic picture of the man standing in front of the tank at Tiananmen Square, the Tiananmen Square massacre, and also the fall of the Berlin Wall. to the communists, there was a massive backlash within the entire Chinese. You understand, the Chinese Communist Party is the biggest party in the world. We're talking about millions of members here. You know, even if you do not, the first thing I want you all take away today is do not overestimate anyone in the Chinese Communist Party, even the president, say Hu Jintao or the one that we have now, Xi Jinping. Everyone calls them strongmen. They're not. It's always been ruled by committee. You know, they are the figureheads. And you have massive amounts of internal resistance because when you have this degree of planned economy, you would build a massive amount of vested interests. So anyways, the vested interests had a massive backlash saying that the reform should stop. In fact, Deng Xiaoping was so precarious in his powers that he had to do a trip down to a special economic zone next to Hong Kong called Shenzhen. This is the billboard in Shenzhen, where I doubt they will ever remove. But he basically says the insistence of the party, the will of the party to maintain the road of reform will not change for 100 years. And that is basically the safeguard for Shenzhen. But Deng Xiaoping's trip to Shenzhen was a high-profile trip trying to force the old guards, the hardliners, back into the roads of reform. In fact, his trip wasn't even reported by the People's Daily. It took the regional Shenzhen newspaper, then leaked to Hong Kong, then leaked back to Beijing, and finally, when news got out that Deng Xiaoping, the supposed paramount leader of China, actually took this trip, that the official state media began to report it. So that was how precarious Deng Xiaoping was at that moment. So he was painted until his death the leader of China from 78 to 1997. He wasn't. I mean, there were times in which he was, you know, his power was very, very threatened. And then from 1992 onwards, you had these two individuals, both of them from Shanghai. The one on the left is Jiang Zemin, and the one on the right is Zhu Rongji. Zhu Rongji, in my opinion, is my favorite. I suspect, honestly, that he is an Austrian school economist himself. You might laugh, and you are like, well, then why is China like this? But you got to understand the cards that are dealt to you as a policymaker. You know, you are entering a certain scenario that has happened for, we Chinese love to say 5,000 years, right? So, you know, that is a situation you inherited, and how do you change it? And you are facing all these vested interests in all sectors of society. You know, the Chinese government used to govern even the way that you dressed. You know, the marriage ceremony that you're supposed to have. And to have that massive withdrawal of the state and to have every single vested interest fight tooth and nail against it. Zhu Rongji is my personal favorite. And in this period, from 1992 to 2007, they did a whole series of things. They did currency reforms, they had dual currency. Of course, a lot of us would inherently be against anything that's not gold or silver based. But they also, the tax system had to be centralized. I mean, this was probably Zhu Rongji's toughest task because taxes used to be collected by local governments, then handed up to the central government. So if you were a local tax collector, you basically would be fighting this one tooth and nail because they're removing your most central power, or at least most central exercise of your coercive power, the tax collection. And then they also let a lot of state and state-owned, small and medium-sized state-owned enterprises go bust. There was a cleaning up of the banking system, and there was a listing of the biggest state-owned enterprises. I understand completely. I mean, myself, in my columns and my TV shows and my radio shows, have always said that by simply listing a state-owned enterprise onto a stock market is not enough because you're simply inviting private cash into still a government-run entity, right? But this idea was that because the state wanted to keep control, but then they had to be accountable to someone, so might as well raise transparency by forcing them to list. At least their numbers can't be crooked, or else they could be arrested by jurisdictions like Hong Kong. And the last one, I think, was a stroke of genius. I mean, you would think that, you know, someone who's interested in power won't do this, but they actually introduced competing national champions. I mean, there are, for example, three oil companies in China that nominally, when they were started, concentrated on different things, but have now become vertical majors and competing directly head-to-head. There are also competing national champions in both telecoms and other major businesses. I mean, if you were dealt with the cards where the state controlled everything through one entity, having multiple entities competing against each other might raise the efficiency of your economy. But at least that was the thinking of Zhu Rongji. I mean, I honestly think that he was an Austrian because of this event. This is a man called Suharto. Suharto was the leader of Indonesia from, I don't know, the 1960s, 65, I think, when the CIA supposedly removed his predecessor, until the year 1997-98. There was a big Asian financial crisis, basically massive amounts of malinvestments everywhere around the East Asian area, and because of fluctuation, both the Japanese yen and the US dollar, capital flight occurred. And the biggest banks of Indonesia, in fact, the four biggest banks of Indonesia, all went bust. And of course, the Suharto asked the IMF to come in and rescue him. And within 24 months, he was basically gone from office. So why is this story so important for the Chinese Communist Party? Well, basically, if you have a banking crisis and you rely on the IMF to solve it for you, they'll remove you from office. So from the Chinese perspective, well, we better get prepared. And the reason why I think that Zhu Rongji is an Austrian school economist is that because he knew that the final sector of the economy waiting to be liberalized, waiting to have competition, or at least a healthy scenario, would be the banking sector. Zhu Rongji probably understood that without fear instilled into depositors, you will have bankers running wild. It could be because of the cronyism, it could be simply because of, you know, for their own bonuses. But if depositors, the only people that can police banks are the creditors of the banks, which are the depositors. Periodic bank runs are good for the entire banking system, right? But Zhu Rongji understand, or at least to the entire Chinese Communist Party, they came to an agreement that, you know, bank runs are bad. So therefore, they knew that malinvestments will occur. In fact, if you tell them, why don't you liberalize, you know, malinvestment will occur. To be honest, I think they know. That is why they prepared themselves. This is the foreign reserves of China. I don't know how accurate this is. Supposedly, they started buying, you know, US Treasury bills through Belgium lately. But this is from 1994 to 2011. You saw the spike up at the turn of the millennium. And the thinking was, well, if we have to rely on a massive pool of capital to recapitalize our banks in case of a banking crisis, then might as well save it ourselves. So if you were to ask me, why do the Chinese accumulate all these foreign reserves? Some people say, oh, it's a mercantilist policy because they want to devalue their yuan and remain competitive in the world. To be honest, if you ask me, then I'll be honest. The honest truth would be they know that a banking crisis will occur. They don't know when, but they want to be prepared. And therefore, they accumulated the biggest, well, in their minds, arsenal to recapitalize their banks. And that is why I think they're Austrians, because they know that the cards that were dealt to them ensures that they will have a banking crisis. And therefore, well, if we can't prevent it by, say, liberalizing the banks now, then the only thing you can do is be prepared for it. Which brings us to this period. This period is the end of the Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao period. These two, in my opinion, are the two least competent leaders of China since 1978. And the reason why is this. This is the total assets reported by the banks in both China and the US. The red line is the US and the blue line is China. It goes from September 2008 to September 2013. As you can see, the Americans did a lot of quantitative easing. The Chinese actually did even more. That is the dirty little secret. I remember a speaker yesterday said that behind every shining city on a hill lies a rotten core. That is the rotten core of the Chinese economy. They had a massive expansion of money supply, unprecedented in human history. It got to the point whereby these shoppers from China came to Hong Kong. They would walk into Hermes, they would walk into Louis Vuitton, Gucci and Chanel, and there would be a long row of handbags, right? The shopper would point at one and say, I want this one, I want this one, and I want everyone in between. For us Hong Kongers, we're like, what? must be rich. You know, that's the consensus we had in Hong Kong, that they were, you know, this is a true nation rising. Look at the amount of handbags they can buy. You know, they were shoes, and Imelda Marcos would be blushing. But it was all debt fuel. And that lies the problem that we see today. All that malinvestment, it wasn't even malinvestment, it was just consumption, to be honest, covered as investment. All that official data you see about the investment levels in China. I mean, you know, yes, the official contract says 200 million for a bridge. 100 million of that has been embezzled, shipped down to Hong Kong as consumption, or around the world as consumption. And the problem, I mean, you would say, well, what's the big deal, right? The big deal is this. The big deal is that this is from Zero Hedge, so it has a little credibility. But this is the chart of a falling return per unit of debt in China. You saw the turning point in 2009. That was when they pushed tens of trillions of dollars into, well, tens of trillions of renminbi into the economy. And you saw a massive plummeting of returns per unit of debt. And yes, you don't have to remind me, supposedly America has been doing this for decades, and yet nothing of consequence has happened to them yet, right? But this is the situation happening in China, right? So the lesson learned, first of all, I was hoping these two, the picture of these two would provoke some sort of reaction from you. But yes, the first lesson learned is that owning the reserve currency has its benefits, right? You can print like crazy, and yet, what was it? I think was it Nixon that says that it's our currency, but it's your problem, or some central banker? Sorry? Yes, yes. All right, oops, sorry. Now, it brings us to this period. I would say that they probably, this is Xi Jinping, this is the president of China right now. That's his prime minister, Li Keqiang. Xi Jinping might not know about economics, but Li Keqiang, once again, I think, you know, he I think he's Austrian school economist as well. Right. I know these are serious allegations I'm making against them, but he should know his stuff. I mean, all the stuff that gets reported in China, by the media about China, take it with a grain of salt, because a lot of journalists have their own mindset about why certain policies happen, and they explain as such. But anyways. These three individuals, probably, you know the one in the middle because I introduced him, that's Sahato. The young ones over there, the young ones in the room, might not know the one with the birthmark on the head. That is Mikhail Gorbachev, that's the last Secretary General of the Communist Party in Soviet Union. And that one, I actually put in a name because they change it so often, you might not know who he is. But that is Miyazawa Kichi, that's the Japanese Prime Minister. These three individuals had one thing in common. I mean, one of them ran a completely, you know, Soviet-style planned economy. One of them ran a dictatorship that was nominally capitalist. This one ran a liberal democracy. So these three individuals have a great impact on Chinese Communist Party thinking, because these three individuals have one thing in common. These three are all leaders of a one-party state that ended suddenly. I mean, Miyazawa Kiichi got thrown out of office. In fact, the Liberal Democrats of Japan got thrown out of office in the 1992 elections. Gorbachev, of course, left when the Soviet Union disintegrated. And Suharto was out of office in 98. And these three nations, in about the 10 years preceding their downfall, had one thing in common, which is every unit of capital, every unit of saving, let's not call it capital, because capital is useful. Every unit of saving pushed into the economy as investments generated lower and lower and lower returns, right? And that is why these two knows that China is in trouble, because every unit of debt is now returning less and less, and they are laying the fundamental groundwork for the downfall of the Chinese Communist Party rule in China. Right, so how do you solve that? Well, basically, malinvestments are holes on the balance sheet of banks, and someone, to use the term that I love using, someone has to eat that loss, right? I mean, in our ideal case, when a banking system goes in trouble, when banks become insolvent, the people who are supposed to lose the money are the depositors and the creditors. Because, you know, as Rothbard says, teach them a lesson. and therefore they can police the bankers. But then they can't do that in China. So what do? They try to create their own reserve currency. They want to promote the renminbi as their reserve currency, right? And then the second plan is to make those least sympathized eat those losses. If you look around yourself, we all wear many hats. And one of the hats that a lot of us wear, I'm sure I wear, is that I am a speculator on the stock market. So the vision was to create this massive bubble in the stock market in China and then ask the companies to print shares and collect in the capital and repay it back to the banks. And once the banks are repaid, the bubble can collapse, and then the shareholders would be the bag holders eating the losses. But unfortunately, with the stock market collapse in China in the past few months, that plan hasn't worked out. But then, of course, people start questioning the currency's value. So therefore, option one has also been taken out because, you know, you used to have all these BRIC nations thinking that we might have to build a renminbi reserve, but that is not going to happen too. So the third plan, the one that was supposedly there were big celebrations, is the Asian Investment Infrastructure Bank, the AIIB. The AIIB basically is a very simple plan. If there are malinvestments in China with excess capacity in things like steel, cement, you name it, we might as well create the demand in neighboring countries. You know, in Burma, in India, in Southeast Asia. Let them pick up the slack. And hopefully these infrastructure projects would raise their efficiency, that they would then create the demand for Chinese consumers or Chinese producers. You know, a virtuous cycle sets in, sort of like a Chinese model copied everywhere else. I don't know whether that's gonna happen because of the current upheaval. You've heard much less about that, but that is the vision. There is no attempt, I mean, there probably is attempt about geopolitical ambition. That's how the Western media likes to paint it. But honestly, it's a very simple plan to transfer the debt risk onto the taxpayers of neighboring countries to create the demand to soak up the malinvestment excess capacity in China. So, if you ask me what Xi and Li would worry about, this would be the four things, I think. Demography, because of the one-child policy, the labor force would peak sometimes in the next 2 years in China. And the time, because all these Chinese Communist Party members are students of history, the same thing happened in Japan in 1990 at the apex of their bubble. So, you know, from the point of view of demography, China probably has peaked. The question of air pollution. The question of air pollution ties back into question five. I'll touch upon that later. But on energy security, that is what I think the Chinese government fears on the perspective of their border integrity. Basically, if the Straits of Malacca, which is off Malaysia, Singapore, if that get closed down, China would come to a halt and the Chinese Communist Party would be removed from office. And the Republic of Singapore, which has a population of about 4 or 5 million indigenous citizens, the Prime Minister, who was the son of the Founding Father, the last place he went to before he became Prime Minister was Taiwan. So if I was the Chinese Communist Party, I would say, you know, this man who is the leader of 4 or 5 million people can basically remove me from office. So you will see a lot of different moves between China and Putin, China and Burma. All these are to circumvent that national security risk. And finally, on the banking crisis, I talked a lot about that, so I'm going to leave that. But question five, because yesterday I remember a speaker talked about time preference. The automatic assumption is that all these Chinese government officials want the perpetual rule by the Chinese Communist Party, right? And that is the assumption. But what if something happened that changed their time preference, so they want to cash out now? I would say that number one unintended consequence of the one-child policy is that when you are a high-ranking government official, you know, with bribery that has amounted to hundreds of millions, if not $1 billion, and you only have one child, what do you do to that child? I mean, all your eggs are in that basket. You know, you would probably send them out to places like Australia, US, England, etc., etc., etc. And that in probably Xi Jinping's mind, is the biggest threat to Chinese Communist rule, which is the rot within the Chinese Communist Party. Everyone wants to cash out now. You arrest me, fine. At least my child will be in a safe place in a Western democracy. So therefore, one of the very strange policies implemented by Xi in the last few years was they have demanded every single government official to repatriate their children back to China. In fact, not only is this applicable to government officials, but it's applicable to even the rent seekers, the owners of the rent seekers. So the two biggest technology company in China, Tencent and Alibaba, the founders' children actually attended my elementary school. And then suddenly, they just got yanked out of the school. Supposedly reason of health. That was what the school told me. You know, I went back, I was like, you know, I heard that, we have some famous alumni, and they were like, yeah, they got yanked out because of health reasons. But basically, even the air pollution now is so bad that even the government Chinese officials, thinking for the sake of their own children, don't want them to stay in China. So that is probably the biggest threat that the Chinese Communist Party is having. And Xi Jinping has been arresting a lot of really high-ranking and powerful Chinese government officials as well. I don't know how safe he is. I mean, at this rate, I think the sword of Damocles is over his head, really chop him at any moment. He probably is as precarious, I think, as when Deng was after the Tiananmen Square massacre. So all that Western media saying that he's the strongest man ever since Deng Xiaoping, I honestly take it with a pinch of salt. And there is massive amounts of factional infighting right now in China. I mean, some people speculate, even I speculate, that one of the parties that poked the stock market bubble was the previous president's faction, the Jiang Zemin faction, because Jiang Zemin wants to cash out, wants to have a lot of corruption continue on, and Xi Jinping knows that that would be a threat to their rule. But finally, Sean Gabe yesterday talked about advancing the Austrian school or the libertarian agenda. I would like to highlight one of the methods that my friend Peter Wong, he's also a board member at the Lion Rock Institute. One of the ways that we found it very useful in advancing the Austrian school economics in Hong Kong was that because it is true, because it works, it lends a great deal of predictive power to those who want to allocate capital in the financial markets. So Peter over there has now followers in the hundreds. They subscribe to the Austrian school economics, not out of principle, but simply because it works. So you guys might try it back in your home country if you can prove to the people, because financial markets are the best. You can be black, green, yellow, whatever color, right? You can be a Martian, but as long as you are right, then you'll be respected. And that is one of the ways that we've been pushing the Austrian school in Hong Kong. So thank you.